You are listening to the Movement Church Podcast, a church located in Hendersonville, Tennessee. The Movement Church exists to grow believers in their faith, equip them to make a difference in the world, and encourage believers to make the next move towards God. For more information, go to movementchurchtn.com.
This is 1 Corinthians chapter 9, starting at verse 17. For if I do this of my own will, I have a reward. But if not of my own will, I'm still entrusted with a stewardship. What then is my reward? That in my preaching I may present the gospel free of charge, so as not to make full use of my right in the gospel. For though I am free from all, I have made myself a servant to all, that I might win more of them. To the Jews I became as a Jew in order to win Jews. To those under the law I became as one under the law, though not being myself under the law, that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law, I became as one outside the law, not being outside of the law of God, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those outside the law. To the weak, I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all people, that by all means I might save some. I do it all for the sake of the gospel, that I may share with them in its blessings. Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one receives the prize? So run that you may obtain it. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. So I do not run aimlessly. I do not box as one beating the air, but I discipline my body and keep it under control, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified. This is God's word. Please have a seat.
Corinthians is written by Paul to a church he started in a community known as Corinth. The critique that was made of Paul preceding this text is that ministers were being paid for preaching the gospel. So he begins to share that that is okay to happen, that you should not muzzle the ox. Paul's defense of himself is not that he is a greedy preacher. There are a lot of greedy preachers. Time has not changed much. But he was saying he was not one of them, and it's not greedy to have an income when sharing the gospel. But he says he is not one of them. He has chosen the life of consecration. And he's showing this to say that the only care he has in his life is to be an instrument of sharing the gospel. He is a man of unceasing anguish. He says, I'm under the law or not under the law. So he's saying, I will embrace the traditions of those who their understanding is that of under the law. I'm not under what they believe they're under, but I will meet them where they are in that. Then he says he is under the law of Christ, which means he's under a law of love in the way of Jesus. So Paul, in all of the nuances of how culture works, which this isn't as pronounced today because of how connected our world is to each other, that typically and traditionally geography would determine culture, the clothes you wear, the traditions you hold. The language, the way you say words, and that's why when people move here, they say, you guys don't speak well. It's like, well, you're in the South now, so you're actually wrong, because this is how we say it here. So this is what Paul was saying. So when Paul says that he would do anything to win, this would include the clothes he wore, the holidays he celebrated, his eating habits, his family practices, and even the speech he would use. So Corinth is a very complex city, much as like we would consider Nashville versus a more country area in the state, that Nashville is a complex place with different cultures. And Paul saying, I will do what I need to do to make myself a servant just to be used by God. Recently in an auction, a set of Jordans, the greatest, if you don't know who Michael Jordan is, wake up and get out from underneath a rock, the greatest basketball player to ever play, these shoes were sold for $8 million. The reason these shoes were sold for $8 million is because since Michael Jordan's the greatest basketball player ever, each pair of these shoes were worn during one of his championship runs in the finals. So they were sold for $8 million. So leather and foam and fabric worth $8 million because it was on the shoes of great, it was on the feet of greatness. And Paul is saying this, God, put me on your feet, use me up, make my life valuable. I think the best way to track through the text today as we make our shift in our series on how to actually leverage your life. So we've talked a lot about who are lost people, how do you reach lost people, but how do you now leverage your life? Today is leveraging your freedom. So this passage of scripture, I think, is best understood backwards by looking at the point of life, the passion of life, and the price of those things. So Paul starts off in verses 24 through 27 making his big point that one day I'm going to die. And when I die, I want it to be a race well run. So his passion on that race, if you're working backwards, is verses 20 through 23, that he wants to reach and win some. The price is in verse 19. Though I'm free, I make myself a servant. So, the point. What is the point beginning in 24 through 27? Paul is dialed into what every life coach will tell you and what motivational speakers will tell you. You always start with the end. You start with a picture of the end. If you want to be a great artist, you have to have a vision of the end in mind before you paint. If you want to cook a good meal, you don't just figure it out as you go along. It's kind of got a vision in mind. If you're going to do a building, I've learned this over the last few months, you don't just start. You actually have to have a vision of what it's going to look like at the end. People who are really into fitness start with an end goal, an end vision. And here's what Paul is saying. This is real comforting news to start your morning off. Eventually, you will die, and that's where you should start, all right? So the day you die, life ends. And Paul has in mind a type of Olympic games that they played in Corinth and uses the metaphor of a race. So the goal of life is eternal reward by living a meaningful life. We'll return to that in a second. That Paul is saying that you right now have to make a choice. Everyone in here is an adult. You have to make a choice right now. Your life is not cast based off of something you went through years ago. You are not... This race, some people will run it as contractors. Some people will run it as accountants. Some people will run it as pastors. Some people will run it as missionaries. But this is the same race for every person. Some will run it as stay-at-home moms. This is not a race about accomplishment. This is not a race that will get you a Barnes & Noble bestseller, which wouldn't matter in Hendersonville anymore anyways because we don't have bookstores anymore. It's not going to get you any of that. This is your race that you have to run, whether it be as a cafeteria worker or as an engineer. And it's to live a meaningful life, and you have to choose that. I want to drill, you have to choose it. It doesn't just happen. It doesn't fall out of the sky and give you a gift. You have to discipline yourself. The metaphor is that of a runner, that of a runner. An English monk was writing the book of John in a language where they didn't have the gospel. And his scribe said, "Master, there's one sentence wanting. Hurry and write it." The monk was about to die. So the monk says, "Hurry and write it." And then his scribe says, "Master, it is done." The monk replies, "Thou hast spoken. It is done. It's now time for me to return who made me. The time of my dissolution draws near. I desire to be dissolved and to be with Christ. Yes, my soul desires to see Christ, my King, in his beauty." Then they picked the man up, the scribe picked him up, placed him on the pavement of his chosen spot, and he sung these words, "Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Ghost." And as he uttered the word ghost, he expired and uttered his last word, finishing his final sentence of the Gospel of John. Man, when I die, I want God to say, "Daniel, that was the last meeting with that young pastor. Your girls are discipled. If I've called them to marriage or if I didn't, their husbands love the Lord. The church is doing great, even if it closed down. It served its purpose. It's time to come home, man. And then lay me in that spot again." That's the race. The race that Paul is speaking of in the Isthmian Games, this was their Olympic Games, was a track race. A 630-foot long track built up on mountains. And as you would be running this race, there were three pillars. One at the start, one halfway, or there's three pillars, one at the start, and the third one's at the halfway mark, and you would turn. And in between those three was a second one. On each of these pillars that you would see, one on the first one at the start line was excel. The one that was in the middle of the three said hasten, and then the third one said turn, and that was your reminder to turn back because the race ends at the finish line. Many of us in life miss the turn. We just keep running in one direction our whole life. Young, youthful enthusiasm, running headlong as hard as we can. Hustle culture, you can do it. Run as hard as you can in one direction and never look back. But the vision that Paul has of a race well run is there comes a moment in life where you should turn, and where you start it becomes the primary vision of this is where it ends. So if you're taking notes, the race ends where it starts. It started coming from God. The race ends in front of God. So you've got to make that turn. That's something I've been wrestling with over the last couple years. For a minute, I was like, I want to help people get healthy. It's like, but Daniel, is that what I've called you to do? Daniel, or you know what? I wanna be a musician. But Daniel, is that what I asked you to do? It's time to turn. You're 37, brother. It's not time to be out here. You know, I know everyone can dream, but you know why you're here. So turn, run hard, get after it, man. Because you're gonna stand before me one day. You've got to make the turn. Man, at what age do you put Instagram down? At what age do you stop just trying to look for hobbies to waste the time? What's the age? What's the moment where your eyes are set on the fact that I will expire and I will not leave until this last sentence is written? Much of our modern life is about looking back, figuring out what went wrong. But life is not about looking back and finding healing. Life is about the present moment that God is at work in that brings healing, purpose, meaning, and everything else. So what is the end? What's the end of the race? So whether you're 14 or whether you're 40, the end of life is eternity, not death. Man, that's so important to get that in your soul. The end of life is eternity, not death. Now, there's a larger conversation about eternity to be had, but just the end of the race is eternity. Paul doesn't say, I want to run the race. So when I just, that last breath comes out and it's all over, people say, Paul crushed it in his life. No, it's so that he could have eternal reward. Eternal reward. The end of life is eternity, not death. That'll be more important in a moment. So then in verse 24, Paul talks about a crown, running to receive the prize. He's speaking about judgment. Followers of Jesus will be accountable to the race. Not your race, the race. Not a race of your choosing, to the race. I know this is intense, but you don't set out to win something by someone saying, hey, at the end, we may do trophies, we may not. I don't know. Let's just have a good time, okay? Let's get out here and have a good time. Paul's saying, no, no, no. You fool. Don't be foolish. You got to run your race. The race. Followers of Jesus will be accountable to the race. Some people will run the race as a third grade teacher. Some people will run the race as a graphic artist. Some people will run the race as a missionary in a third world country. Some people will run the race for any number of jobs that each of y'all do that you explain to me 20 times and I still don't quite understand what you do. But you will run the race. And it's not about getting in ministry. It's not about getting into the mission field. It's about you understanding the race. 1 Corinthians 3, 11 through 15, Paul says, everything in my life is about the race. He goes on to say that in the end, all of our actions will either be gold, silver, and precious stone, or wood, straw, and hay. So instead of me listing out what those may be, a couple of questions you could ask yourself. One, what will matter most in eternity? That's gold, silver, and precious stone. So what will matter most? And I encourage you to get detailed. You know, how good of a dad I am. Will that matter most in eternity? What will matter most in eternity was, were you faithful with your child? According to Christ. Your job's important, but is it the most meaningful thing, or is it the coworker there in need of the gospel? Two, does that thing matter most presently? So if it's going to matter the most eternally, does it matter most presently? And three, is it getting your best energy? Not a little energy, your best energy. John Wesley, the preacher, I value all things only by the price they shall gain in eternity. The goal of running the race is not to be busy. The busiest person you know is a child. They accomplish very little in a given day, all right? The goal of your life is to not run your race, the race. It's easy to confuse the goal and the means. I want to explain this. So people say, my goal in 2024 is to eat less sugar. That's confusing the goal and the means. A real goal sounds something like this. My goal is to be healthier by eating less sugar. It's really easy to make the means eating less sugar the goal, eating less sugar. So it's pointless. It's going nowhere. So looking at this, this is slide one, Josh. If this is the way this is supposed to work, the goal of life is eternal reward by living a meaningful life. So the goal is eternal reward. The means is a meaningful life. Okay? This is very easy to confuse because here's how it gets contorted very quickly because of how fast we're running. The goal of life is to live a meaningful life by and then fill in the blank. So there's no eternity in mind. It's the goal of life is to live a meaningful life by being successful, a good parent, being desired by someone desirable, becoming wealthy by being religious. So this is confusing the goal from the means. And Paul is lasered in. He says, you won't catch me with that. The goal of my life is eternal reward by living a meaningful life, running the race. So the goal of your life, if it's something like this, to be successful, I think you're confused. In 100 years, your definition of success will be failure. Ask the guy who put lead in paint and made a lot of money over it. What about the doctors that were recommending cigarettes? The top of their work that day, right? So, like, time is not greatness. Time is not a friend to personal greatness. Just heads up, okay? So, and if you don't believe me, there's probably a graveyard of statues nowadays that have been torn down to testify. So this is about something that is so easy. The goal of your life is not to raise good kids. The goal of your life is eternal reward by being a godly parent, discipling, and becoming a discipleship outpost at your home. The goal of life is not to be a good worker. The goal of life is eternal reward by becoming salt and a light in a workspace, becoming an outpost of discipleship where you are. Now, here's what this means. This is stunning if you think about what Paul's saying. You can waste your life recklessly or carefully, without a biblical end in mind. Recklessly, are you living like you're not in a race? Do you have endless amounts of time for fun times and good vibes? Man, you're in a race. I know you need a breather called Sabbath, but your life is a Sabbath. And not the one God called. Like, are you just out just, yeah, man, I may move to Nebraska next week, I may not. I may go up to New York. I may not. I may show up at what I'm supposed to be at. I may not. I may stay up till 3 and then not work at my job tomorrow. I don't know. And, like, this is a vision we have of wasting life. And to be sure, this is a waste of life, painting your face for sports teams and things of the nature. This is a waste of life, becoming known, like, at the end of the year, people are so proud. Oh, look, I'm in the 0.01% of listening to this artist. And every time someone posts it, I'll say, do you really want to brag about that? All right? Is that like, man, I want to tweet this. I dedicated 23% of my year to being good at Madden football games. Like, is that what you want the world to see? Wow. I know it sounds harsh, but it's because we get pulled into these things, man. You need a coach who will pull you aside and say, are you wasting your life? But secondly, you can waste it carefully. Are you prioritizing beautiful but perishable crowns? That's what Paul's saying. Beautiful crowns. At the end of the Isthmian Games, they would put this crown on you full of beautiful, just ornate, and everything on it died. There's a lot of beautiful things that you can carefully waste your life with. Methodical, incredible budget. You have an incredible budget. You have a budget that makes Dave Ramsey feel inferior, and you're wasting your life. Never, never, never would miss a Sunday gathering. Wasting your life. Carefully, oh so carefully, because you're trying to get a perishable crown. Are you fighting the air is a question that Paul asks. All of the work of demonic activity in your life is getting energy going in the wrong direction. Getting the energy made for intimacy in the direction of lust. Getting the energy of forgiveness moving in the direction of bitterness. And it works just like this too. Getting the energy God gave you running in the wrong direction. And it could be spent on Broadway, or it could be spent in the quiet of your home reading a book. The race is moving. This is the whole goal of all demonic temptation, is just to get all of that goodness that God's put in you funneling in the wrong direction. Man, I look back on the last 5 to 7 years just looking at some of the most selfish thinking I've ever had. And it was just, maybe one day I'd want to do this. Maybe one day I want to do this. Like, Daniel, you're not 14 anymore. And it's not that you can't dream later in life. It's I was thinking to myself, what do I want to do? Daniel, you've been bought with the blood of Jesus Christ. Your life is not your own. What do I want you to do with your life? And put your foot in the ground and go. Get after it. I recently was asked to fill out a sheet of how I spend my hours. I sent it to someone. He sent it back. He said, Daniel, you worked 81 hours last week. Here's what you did during those 81 hours. You look at that. Man, you designed some banners. Congratulations. You stink at it. Stuff's way better. Oh, look at this. Look at this. This is cool, Daniel. Look at what you did here. And like in the midst of it, I'm like, gosh, man, I kind of felt like maybe the Nobel Peace Prize was starting to look at me for the work I was doing. And now that I'm seeing it on a sheet of paper, I'm not sure that I'm running as hard as I could. Not because I'm not working enough hours, because I'm carefully wasting my life. C.S. Lewis, everything that is not eternal is worthless in eternity. Daniel Pink has a book called The Power of Regret and did a study. He said there's 4 types of regret. Foundational regret, moral regret, boldness regret, relational regret. Foundational regret is things like, I wish I would have done better in school. I wish I wouldn't have married that person and that happened. These are the things you'll look back on life and they were just foundationally a part of who you were and things you did. So if you're under the age of 18, 20 years old right now, you have time to mitigate as many of those as humanly possible. A foundational regret is when people were telling you should invest in your retirement right now. You'll have $5 million in the bank if you just put a little bit in it. And you were like, no, I don't want to do that. I'm going to actually go out to eat and grab a pizza tonight. And then you're later, you're like, I have just foundational regret. If I would have just put $100 in this account the rest of my life, I'd be free to serve the Lord right now. But instead, I'm going to eat pizza again because that's just what we, it's a foundational regret. We all have them. Second's a moral regret. Wish I wouldn't have slept with that person. Wish I wouldn't have made that call. Wish I wouldn't have went there. Moral regret. Boldness regret is, man, I wish I would have spoke up. I wish I would have applied for that job. Relational regret. Man, I wish I would have been a better friend. I wish I would have grown up and not ruined that relationship. But of all these regrets, the one that didn't make the list is the one Paul says, I am fighting to not have. Eternal regret. Eternal regret. Listen, folks, there's no way around it. You're going to have some foundational regrets. You're going to have some moral regrets. You're going to have some boldness regrets. You're going to have some relational regrets. But if you get fixated on those things, you'll turn the means into the goal. I regret I didn't go to school. That's what I have. So the goal of my life is to be seen as smart. Waste your life carefully, Daniel. I'm putting my business out there for you right now so you can apply it to yourself. Eternal regret. Van Gogh did a drawing called Worn Out. Shows an old man crouched over, long day's work. He liked it, but he said it didn't capture the full emphasis of what he wanted. So a few years later, he did another one called Eternity's Gates. It's the same old man. Hands covering his face as he realizes that life is truly over now and he's awaiting to see how his race has been. Van Gogh is getting at something that I have learned all too well and Paul is warning us against. You could be running so hard in one direction, worn out, that you forget eternal gate is being painted right now as well. Eternity is ever present in the mind of Paul. 2 Corinthians 4:17-18, these light momentary sufferings are nothing compared to the eternal weight and glory. Eternity is always on his mind. Myself, and for many of us, eternity is not really on our mind all the time. So where your creative imagination ends is your functional end. Now, I know many of us don't consider ourselves to be creative, but you are creative. And there's something in the, not some of you, not a lot, all right, let's just say it. Some of you, I mean, it's just barely there. But you have the ability to look down the road of life and say, this is where I want to be. So that is your creative end. Now, you should have goals. You should have dreams. Like I said earlier, I do want to play an instrument one day. I'm just not on earth to do it, all right? So I have things that I see later in life that I want to do. There's nothing wrong. I do want to do school, but this is things that I see later in my life, all right? So these goals are great, but I'm talking the last vision in your brain. What is the furthest thing from you right now that you envision? Is it when you turn 30? Is it when you get retired? That's going to be for most of us. Whatever it is it when this, there's something that is the most consuming last thing that you dream about. This is the functional end of your life. Your brain will interpret that as the purpose of life is, how do I get to this moment? A few of the most common ones are life stages. When you're in high school, the most functional end for most ones is when I find true love and I'm living in blissful independence in the beauty and goodness of life. When you're in your 20s, you look back on your high school self and say, what was I thinking? What was I thinking? The meaning of life I can't wait for is may still be true love. And career, it's not just to be on my own, it's to be a meaningful place. And then when you're in your 30s, you say, man, that 20-year-old me didn't get it. He was so narrow. She was so narrow. She wasted so much of her life. What was she doing? The goal of life is to be successful in a career and have a great friend group. And if you continue the exercise, yes, the 40-year-old version of you thinks the 30-year-old version of you is dumb. The 50-year-old does, the 60-year-old. The most honest, sober way of thinking is the last few days. Life is not about retirement. I personally hope that my retirement is maybe from a career, but not from work. Secondly, is your functional end the mere urgency bias? This is a theory. This is why you answer emails with your best energy or with your time instead of thinking long and hard about things that may actually make big changes. It's what feels urgent takes precedent over what's most meaningful. So the mere urgency bias is the functional end of your life, the urgency of a moment when this season's over. Is it the 2024 election? Is it what sports say? The biggest thing coming is April's NFL draft. And then the biggest thing coming is NFL training camp. And then the biggest thing coming. And that's exactly how we live, one thing from the next. It's tech. Oh, man, wait until these goggles come out where you can watch TV like you always have, but just look so strange while you're doing it. You can count down to this right now. It's coming. It could be work. The next thing is this deadline. It could be a show. I can't wait till they go see this. What about highlighting life? Holidays. Oh, I can't wait for Christmas. Well, you know we got some months to go, right? I know, but that's all I'm thinking about. Highlighting life. An event. Oh, I can't wait for this trip. It's the only thing on my mind. 2 months of life. I'm going to burn these hours down, baby, because I cannot wait to get to this moment. A moment of relief. Oh, finally. This is over. What about a feeling? Oh, when I finally find healing, when I finally feel successful. Now, here's what Paul says. Take all of those. Some of those are good. Some of them are a waste of your life. He says the secret of life is this. The motivating force of your life should be a vision of heaven. He has a vision of heaven when he says, I want a wreath that's imperishable. What my life matters for, I want it to matter where there is no time. Things don't die. Heaven. Heaven, to hear, well done, thy good and faithful servant. The Boston Marathon is 24.8 miles. Based on the legend of a Greek foot soldier, he ran that far to say, rejoice, we have conquered. Here's a picture of a man finishing the marathon. This is what all of us should look like when everything ends. Not retirement. Yeah, we're just comfortable. I crossed the finish line more rested than ever, more selfish than ever, more about me than ever. I left so many resources that will never be used.
In fact, Ecclesiastes says, if you spend your whole life saving up for the future, that your life was meaningless because your kids are going to ruin it. That's in the Bible. This is what we should look like. A man who says, man, it was so hard raising this kid, but I crossed with this calling that God gave me. God gave me this family, and man, it was anguish for decades watching this child. But God called me to this race and called me to these people. Man, I'm pushing with everything I got. Some of y'all just need to hear this today. Man, you got to keep going. You got to keep going. You just got to keep pushing. Man, I fought and I fought for decades against this temptation towards pornography, and it was a battle. And I won some, I lost some. But man, I strive to be like Christ, and here I am, and I cannot wait to cross the line into glory. And here, well done, that good and faithful servant. Man, it's so hard to labor in this area, to have this family and these people. But man, what's it going to look like when this is your image? When this is this picture that you have of, man, you made it. And some of you, man, you just keep going. This isn't about saving the world. This is about being faithful to the people you've been called to be faithful to. I struggle with the idea of eternal reward because first, does it make me selfish to do things for eternal reward? And Paul's like, no, it doesn't, because I'm literally doing it just for eternal. I mean, he loves the Lord, but his reason in 1 Corinthians is, I just want a reward. And secondly, because I struggled with the idea of eternal reward for a long time. My motive's pure. Is this okay? So I started thinking that if our lives are going to be judged, does that mean there's going to be people like mourning in heaven? Like there's people who are really happy they made it. Then there's people who made it, but they just ain't got a lot to show for themselves. So it's kind of like there's a cool kids table even in heaven. Gosh, I thought I was done with that at beach. And we're going to have to do it again? Ah, I'm never going to be Billy Graham. I'm going to be sitting in the corner of this daggum place for the rest of my life. And if he's getting the mansion, I'd be happy to have a mailbox somewhere, right? So like, is this how it works? You got it all wrong. Revelations 4, 10 through 11 says there's going to be a moment where we cast our crowns at the feet of Jesus. Okay? So this is the vision I want you to have of your life. Last week was our, Andrea and I's anniversary. And she was like, Daniel, man, I know you've been, things are stressful. She didn't say Daniel, man, but that's how I'm recounting it. That's how we talk to each other. Andrea, girl. you don't have to worry about getting me a gift. You don't have to plan anything. And she's always very kind and compassionate about these things. She said, I don't need you to do anything. It's fine. I felt that I needed to do something, not because she didn't mean it, but I was not going to have this very important day and have nothing to show her that I'm glad this day happened. And when Christ walks by, I want to have something to sling at his feet. I don't want Jesus, not that he needs anything from me, to have nothing to throw at his feet, but say, hey, Jesus, I crushed it on the TikTok. You see that? Jesus, man, thank you so much. Just a heads up. I voted Republican for 8 straight elections. Jesus, oh, wow. I can't believe I'm here. Do you know I had a six-pack late in my 40s? Jesus, I died a millionaire. As you're standing on streets of gold. Now, you know what I want to be able to do? Jesus, I have no idea how the grace and mercy of your cross worked through me, but for some reason they gave me a crown, and now that you're walking by, the only thing that makes logical sense for me is to throw it so quickly at your feet and say, worthy. I will not let this special day go by. So live in such a way that you will have something to throw at the feet of Jesus to express the gratitude you feel when you see him. Quickly, the passion. The passion is to win the race. So how do you win the race? We are in a race, Paul says, to become and win some. Verse 21, Paul says these words. To those outside the law, became as one outside the laws, and here in these parentheses, not being outside the law of God, but under the law of Christ. And then in verse 27, he says, I don't want to disqualify myself. So one step in the race is to become like Jesus. Dallas Willard says the most important thing in your life is not what you do, it's who you become. That's what you'll take into eternity. So two questions to ask yourself on becoming like Jesus. Do you ask questions on, is this right or wrong, or is this Christ-like or sinful? Secondly, are you increasingly becoming a person of love? And the best way to find out is asking people in this order. Ask your friends, your neighbors, and your enemies. Secondly, we are not only in a race to win, to become, but to win some. Paul says in verse 24 and 19, man, I want to win some. So if we look at 24, he says, do not run in a way to where you won't receive the prize. Well, what's the prize? If you go back to verse 19, how do you run to win a prize? Well, verse 19 says, it's to win some. So the race is not about moving quickly in one direction. The race is about people. Political groups prioritize territory. Companies prioritize market share. Social media prioritizes attention. Divisive people prioritize winning arguments. Greedy people prioritize money. Lust prioritizes pleasure. The Christian faith prioritizes people. In the end, people matter most, specifically their soul. Specifically their soul. Man, get your vision on the soul of a person. Get your vision on the soul of a person. Do people's physical wellness matter? Absolutely. Mental awareness, wellness matter? Absolutely. But the soul matters most. As a country, we do not value a person. The most deceptive ideology in America today is that a person can be terminated when they aren't perceived as useful. This is as extreme as abortion. You are not going to be useful. You are terminated. To social circles, you are not useful to me. You're terminated. I don't care if you die on the vine socially. You're terminated. It's deplorable. It's a plague of our world. So what is the value of a soul? I'm going to put a priority chart on the screen. This is not law. This is just if you were to ask me based off of my understanding of Scripture, this is what I see. I see in the kingdom, this is how things are prioritized. The condition of your soul. First and foremost is the condition of your soul. Secondly, it's the condition of your heart or mind, or I could argue that it's the condition of all people's soul. Now, the reason I put those together is if you're not well mentally and if you're not well in the heart, the scriptures say you're going to create converts of hell. Doesn't necessarily sound like a great thing to be spending your life doing, to say, well done, that good and faithful servant, but it came from Satan. Plot twist, that was a weird voice that just came out. I thought Jesus would sound nice when he said it. But it wasn't him. So I would say that the priority of your life, that would share a line together. And then the fourth priority of your life is the condition of all others' hearts and minds. And then tied for fifth is the condition of your body and other people's bodies. Jesus demonstrated the top one. That's what I would argue with you. That Jesus said the most important thing is someone's soul. The bottom one, the number one priority is my body. Do I feel good? Am I doing good? Two, how's my mind? How's my interest? Three, then the condition of my soul. Four, the condition of some people's bodies, specifically the ones that impact me. And five, the condition of some people's minds, specifically the people I like. And here's my argument. Peter and Gethsemane picked the bottom. Jesus and Gethsemane picked the top. Is this how you value people? Could someone look at your life and say, which of these charts would they say, no, Daniel's going to put himself first. You need to know that. Man, what would your kids say? How do you speak about people? What do your coworkers say? This is the life of Jesus. This is the heart of Jesus bleeding out. Well, what about my body? Jesus was crucified for the condition of other souls, so that can't move up. Isn't my mental wellness better than my soul? I mean, only if you are delusional about the depth of your soul and how connected they are to your mind. We could spend weeks on this. Man, but here's what I love about souls. The text says this, people's souls are not conquered or controlled. They are one. They are one. Now, to win some, Paul says, live with winsome conviction. You like the way I did that? That was such a good preaching thing that you may not have realized there. If you want to win some, have a winsome conviction. Okay. I mean, if you're in the field right now, you're impressed. But if you're not, you don't care, and you're saying shut up and finish. So, winsome. What is winsome conviction? You want to win someone over? Paul says it's the art of understanding a person in order to make truth most approachable. That's what you're doing. Well, Daniel, that sounds like you're watering down the gospel. I don't know. That's what Jesus did. He made himself the most approachable version ever. A baby, lived with people, participated in what would have been a meaningless festival for someone who already was in heaven. Changed his clothes. Ate, I'm sure, worse food than he was enjoying before. And presented truth. I mean, get a vision of your life that God could use you to win a soul. Wow. Hospitality to others and fidelity to Jesus is not only possible, it's commanded. Now I'm going to get off on a tangent for 1 second, okay? Tolerance is a demonic alternative to hospitality. We are called to hospitality, to sit at tables and drink coffee and eat food and welcome people of different viewpoints into our home. You are not called to change the gospel so that people will feel like you won their soul over. Now, you can do both, because if you're too quick to shout amen, you may be the one who thinks you don't have to win a soul. You can conquer one. You can control one. You can manipulate one. But we are taught hospitality. Jesus taught hospitality, not tolerance. And church, we've got to wrestle with this statement. If you make a deal with the devil to make a convert, you didn't make a Christian, you became a pagan. If you changed the gospel to win one, you didn't win them. You lost. And you lost big time. And just because, I mean, the church has at some point got to have something that we believe in or are actually proud of and be hospitable. Through winsome conviction, you can win a soul. The price. Michael Phelps, he's won a couple races. I don't know if you've heard, the most decorated Olympian ever. When he trains 6 hours a day, swims 50 miles a week, eats 12,000 calories a day. None of those on McDonald's either. So, like, that's a lot of work. This is what Michael Phelps teaches. If you want to win the race, lay down your freedom. I'm about to come for some of y'all's idol right now. Heads up. One Greek philosopher, in speaking about the Isthmian Games, said this about the runners. Thou must be orderly, living on spare food, abstaining from confections, make a point of exercising at the appointed times in the heat and cold. You want to win the race? Lay down your freedom. Verse 19, Paul says, I've made myself a slave. Verse 1, he says he's free. What's it to him? He's made himself a slave, even though he's free. Freedom is synonymous with America. I love our freedom. I think our freedom is a hope for the world. But it sounds like this: you are free to do whatever brings you life and happiness so long as you don't infringe on another's life and happiness. And that may work for a nation, but it does not square with the Christian faith. Because then we take that definition and say, freedom means I can and should be able to do whatever I want as long as it's not a sin. Is this biblical? Paul says no. Paul in this text says, I keep under. I keep under is a phrase, it's a metaphor, which means I strike myself under the eye. In boxing, in their day, they use oxhide gloves filled with lead and iron. A little masculine, I would imagine, to be able to do that. My elbow hurts thinking about carrying the glove. So here's what Paul's saying. I wake up every day, put those gloves on, and beat the mess out of my flesh. Just punch myself in the eye. Until it's over, until it has no life. You want to win the race, that's what it's going to take. So if your mentality on life is, I'm not sinning, well, then you're not running, if that's your mentality. Christianity is not just about commands, it's about callings. You know, you can sin by forsaking the calling of God, Well, I didn't break a command. I didn't sleep with the wrong person. But you're selfish. You're not serving people. It's a call. And listen, man, I'm not here to beat anyone up. I'm here to be your coach today. You want to win? Because here's what the vision is in my head today. When you cross that line, man, I want to make that little eye contact moment. We point at each other, and we're like, we did it, man. I don't want to throw my crown down at the ground, look over at you, and you're over here fiddling your thumbs, trying to wonder, like, what am I going to do? He's coming, and I want to throw something at his feet. Man, biblical freedom's different in two ways. Biblical freedom is not only the ability to choose, it's the ability to not choose. Biblical freedom means I am free. I am not under the rule of Pharaoh, but I can also choose not to gratify my flesh. Secondly, biblical freedom is the right discipline. We went to a show on Wednesday night. Incredible musicians, incredible vocals. These people had never really met each other, most of them. I was like, well, how do they play the music so well? They just listened to it one time. Here's why they were able to do it. They learned the discipline so that they could be most free. True freedom is the right discipline. The Bible gives us different restrictions. We have moral restrictions as followers of Christ. Ten Commandments, Sermon on the Mount. We have human restrictions. We're supposed to follow the life of Jesus. We have communal restrictions. You should do nothing to break the unity of the family of faith. You also have energy restrictions, the mission of God. So I'll say it this way. Is it a sin to buy this car versus that car? You're missing the question. How will you run your race based off the debt you're about to get into? That's how runners run. Is it a sin to be in this neighborhood or that neighborhood? Is it a sin to eat at this restaurant or that restaurant? Is it a sin? And Daniel, that's exhausting, because what if this is a stumbling block for this person? What if this is a stumbling block for this person? And Paul's like, oh, you're getting it. That's what I'm saying. And do everything, not to violate the gospel, but to win some. I mean, you could be wasting your life so carefully. Paul teaches us you are free to spend your life as you would like, but in the end, you are not free from the race. So you are free to spend your money however you want. The only problem is you're not, because you're on the race. You're free to do whatever you want on Tuesday night, but you're not. You're free to choose your friends and alienate others, but you're actually not. So leverage your freedom. How do you leverage your freedom? Thank you for asking. They're going to put all these on the screen. I got this list from someone. I'll share who in a moment. You want to use your freedom? I'll even get out of the way for you, okay? You want to use your freedom to win some? Start filling your table based on God's call to people, not personal preference. Secondly, differentiate between primary, secondary, and temporary doctrines. Well, I want to win some, but I don't like the way this person's personality is. Ah, I forgot the Apostles' Creed had the line about personalities in it. Now you got to lay that down. Man, don't hand people a 1,000-page statement of belief that, what must I do to be saved? Believe. So he said, and follow the way of Jesus. So what Paul said, you got to know the difference. So like, secondary things matter, but you need to know the difference between all of them. Third, relationally be a student before you're a teacher in a relationship. Paul's in Corinth. He needs to learn about this pluralistic, complex society. So instead of telling people why they're wrong and you're right, listen before you speak. Be who others need you to be, not who you want to be. Authenticity is often a disguise for immaturity. It's just who I am. And Paul says, and you know what's crazy now that you know that? Is you can change it right now for someone else. Well, if you don't like me as I am, you don't love me. And Paul's like, yeah, well, if you want to grow up. 5, do what's best for others, not what you want. 6, enforce others' preferences on yourself, not your preferences on others. And finally,
do things that are meaningless to you because of how deeply meaningful they are to others. Paul gave up meat. Paul went to festivals that meant nothing to him. Paul even changed his clothes, what holidays he celebrated. Now, I got this list. He said, this is lunacy. No one would ever do this. On Palm Sunday, Jesus did every one of them. Palm Sunday, he did every one of them. This list is what Jesus would have said. This is a great starting point. Jesus is relationally on Palm Sunday close to people who mean nothing to something that would add to his agenda. He's enforcing pain on himself for others that they might know him. So this is what's so beautiful about the gospel is Christ gave up freedom because of unceasing anguish for you. So I'm not asking you to do anything extreme. I'm just asking you just to be a disciple of Jesus. Everything I listed today is not extreme Christianity. This is Christ-like 101. And I know you're a free American and you can do whatever you want. The only problem is you can't. Because the race is moving. So whether you're 14 years old, or you're 40 years old, man, I just want to tell you today, you got to keep going. It's time for you to make the turn, set your eyes on eternity, knowing with everything in me that there's going to be a day I cross that line and I'm going to hear my Heavenly Father shout it out, well done, my good and faithful servant. And I'm coming in, I'm high-fiving everybody saying, man, I gave it everything I got while I was out there. And they say, well, you had that dumb little phase there where you were talking about, maybe I want to do fitness. And then you were like, no, you idiot. We got after it, though. I did it with a group of people in Hendersonville while they were getting after it. You see that guy over there? Man, he's awesome, right? You saw the race he was running? I got to be a part of that for a couple of days. Man, isn't that an amazing vision that you could win somebody? Well, I don't know how to articulate the gospel. You know how to be a good human? Do you know how to learn what people want to eat? Do you know how to self-diagnose the terrible parts of your personality that are hard to be around and change them for the glory of God? Gosh, that's so cool, man. Man, I saw this video. We're actually crying like a baby watching this. A father and son reunited after 25 years. There's no sound because I don't want you to cry because I want you to be thinking about this. How cool would it be to be a part of this? To see somebody get to hug their father? Because what are we winning someone to? Not movement, church. So that sons can meet their dad again, called Christ. So that sons can live in the way of Jesus again. So that daughters can know the community exists in the kingdom again. That's what this thing's about. That's what this is all about. This isn't about us. It's never going to be about us. So get over you. Because the race is awesome, man. It's fun out here. Stop navel-gazing at yourself. You don't have to be a missionary. Run as hard as you can as a stylist. Run as hard as you can as a student, as a single person. Run as hard as you can as a librarian or as a department store worker, man. Just go. These lives, man, you're made for something. Get over yourself. That's where joy will be. So on Palm Sunday, man, just see Jesus limiting his freedom. Man, so three groups. I know the chairs are uncomfortable and you're ready to get up. Three groups, man. Maybe you're wasting your life recklessly. Man, you're just not being intentional about your life. Man, repent of that. Get on that race. Two, you're wasting your life carefully. Meaning and goals have become conflated. You don't even think about eternity. Or three, maybe you're just not running as hard as you should. Man, let's just today say, you know, the best way to learn how to run is one day you just go. Let's stand. Man. You know why the seats are uncomfortable? You weren't made to sit in a seat your whole life, all right? You like, I'll turn that around, all right? So
All right, man, I want you to close your eyes, not because of embarrassment. Man, you've been dreaming about this magic moment when you turn 62 years old and everything finally breaks and works. Man, forget that. Man, what's it going to be like when the cloud of witnesses? They see you slide across. The sweat dripping down your head. Legs weak. Tired from loving kids who didn't want to follow. Exhausted from trying to figure out how to live out the gospel in an office. Just like the prodigal father, they put a robe on you, a ring on you, a crown on you. And the heavenly father says, "Well done, that good and faithful servant." That ring immediately comes off and is thrown. That crown crashes to the ground in front of the only one worthy of a crown. And you fall down at his knees and he lifts you and says, "The race is over." That's a vision that crushes retirement, that crushes true love. People to your left, to right, let me say to them, this isn't about going and just winning the world. This is about loving your daughter again. And Christ saying, "When I was thirsty, you gave me water." And he's talking about your kids. "When I was hungry, you fed me." And it's a vision of that little 8-month-old who always needs to eat. And you were praying for her. You were praying for him. You were running while other people were scrolling. You were running while other people were plotting for their self. And no one knew your name. But the heavens say, "There's that runner, man, we've been watching for years. Welcome home." It's time for you, church, to carry your cross. Carry your cross to the glory of Jesus. It says in Scripture, no man sets out to build without counting the cost. What's it going to cost you to run the race? A few moments to contemplate that. And then we'll sing together.